Morning glory and evening grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Night has fallen in Kobani. We do not know how far ISIS has advanced into that city. We know that Turkey is refusing to send ground troops at this hour. We also know that the Ebola patient in Spain, her conditioning is worsening, but the deputy in Dallas County turned out not to have the virus. That is good news. We also know that we'll bring you anything that breaks on any story at any time. Listen more and learn more on the Hugh Hewitt Show. In the first 2 hours of today's show, I've been talking with my three guests in studio about this remarkable new book by Giora Rome. Major General Rome's book is Solitary, The Crash, Recovery, and Resurrection of an Ace Fighter Pilot. General Rome was Israel's first fighter pilot ace, shooting down five MiGs in the Six-Day War. He was himself shot down in 1969, endured 3.5 months of very brutal captivity, including long stretches of solitary. By my guess, I calculated, Giora, about 500 hours of interrogation. I was trying to figure out how many hours, how many days you spent in solitary, and how many days they would interrogate you all night long. Am I right about 500 hours of interrogation?
Well, I never calculated the time, but this was night after night. And when I try to think today, what did they have so much to ask me? I have difficulties to recall, but it was night after night from about 10 p.m. until 3 or 4 a.m., with all kind of minute question about the Air Force and the way we flew our planes, what techniques did we use, and names, places, numbers, all the time.
And the details of how that combat in a cell goes on is fascinating. That's why you should read Solitary Number One. By the way, I found it touching your interest in the Apollo space program. obviously, it makes sense. You're a pilot. You want to know about it, but you know you wanted to know about Apollo 12. And when they were being nice to you, they would parcel out a detail of knowledge.
Yeah, I was perplexed by the space program. And on July 21st, 69, I was in New York with my wife, and we were watching the landing on the moon, which I think that was one of the most unforgettable moments of our time. So when I was in Egypt and I had that Said, who was the intelligence officer, was in charge of me, I called him once and I said, look, I know I POW, you want to beat me, you want to interrogate me. This is not important. There is going to be Apollo 12 soon. And I want to know for sure that the Americans did it again. They went all the way to the moon, they landed on the moon, and they came back safe. Please tell me that. Put aside the conflict between Israel and Egypt. And, you know, he didn't say anything about that. I don't think that he was moved by Apollo 12 as much as I. And then one night, like, I don't recall the time of Apollo 12. I was in solitary confinement, but at that night, like at midnight, they took me out. So there's four soldiers put me on a gurney. They closed my eyes. And on the way from the solitary confinement to my room, Said grabbed my hand and say, Captain, Apollo 12 is on its way to the moon. Which was very nice of him, you have to admit.
You know, there's a regular guest on the show, David Allen White, who is a retired professor at the Naval Academy, where you'll be speaking. And David believes that Norman Mailer's book on the moon landing is the great classic of the 20th century, and that man stepping on the moon is the greatest achievement that we will be known for when our species is long gone by the rest of the intelligence in the universe. Have you ever read Norman Mailer's book about
that? Yeah, I have. I remember, of a fire on the moon. I read it at the time, but I haven't read it since.
He thinks it's like the great American undiscovered. Discovered book, classic, yeah. And so that's Stephen Pressfield agreeing about that. I found that fascinating, but now let's get to your recovery. You get back, and at one point, of course, they have to re-break your bones, they have to reset your arms, and you just glide over that. That's like three pages in Solitary. Solitary is not about medicine. Israel must have some awfully fine surgeons, though, because they put you back so that you can become a fighter pilot again.
We have magnificent doctors, and I had the decision that I want to fly. I told them, do whatever it takes to make me flyable again. And I went through, I guess, six or seven major operations in my leg and in my elbow to be able to stretch or to bend them and to be able to sit in a cockpit of a Mirage, which was the working environment of not more than 100 people in Israel to fly a Mirage. And I wanted to fly a Mirage. I knew intuitively, as I said before, that might cure me from that trauma. So after 13 months of medical recovery, I made my first solo flight.
And you call your father.
I called my father at night, and I said, "Father, today I flew a Mirage." And he could have said, "Giora, are you crazy?" He didn't know that I was planning to do it. We never discussed it seriously. And he could come with any other many answers, but he said, "Son, I congratulate you," which in a nutshell, it's the essence of his education, of his history, of his understanding that we are there to serve the country or to do something which is beyond our personal fate, because he left Poland at 1925 when he was 19. He left his family and come to Palestine at that time, and then he brought all his family before the Holocaust and everything. But he was a Zionist, and the same was my mother, and that was the education I went through at my parents' house. And I guess that when you ask yourself later on, why did you do A, B, or C, you should look backwards to the books that you read in your at your parents' house, to the discussion around the table in the dinners, the Shabbat dinners. And I owe a lot to my father. And when my children had the 19th birthday, every time I looked at them and said, that was the day when my father left his warm family in Warsaw and went to Israel. And I knew that all the medals that I have was nothing compared to the medal that he never received, but what he did.
And when he said, "I congratulate you," twice.
So he said, "I congratulate you." And I knew that he was sitting in his armchair and he has tears in his eyes because he was a very emotional person. But he and my mother, they gave me all the support, even though I know I was not an easy son to have.
I know a little. I can glimpse your father. I know he's dead now. But when in 73 you go during the war, we'll talk about this after the break, to see them during the war and then to visit the missing families, one of whom was your best friend.
Yes.
And he grasps his heart and says, "Not Menachem."
Yes.
And then you go and visit Menachem's father. And he cries out, "Give me back Menachem." These are very beautifully written passages. They're extraordinary, actually. Was Menachem's father also a Zionist from Europe?
Very much. Very much. And Menachem's father fought in the War of Independence in 1948. And in fact, what happened was that 6 months after Menachem's body was found in his Skyhawk aircraft plane in the Suez Canal, his father went to it's called Hill 69, where he fought in the 1948 in the Independence War committed suicide. Oh. Shot himself in the head. It was very hard to take. He couldn't take Menachem, the loss of Menachem.
What was Menachem's last name?
Eyal.
Yeah, it's in the middle, the ability to focus with your best friend missing. And I think, did you lose 7 planes from your squadron, 115?
Yeah, we lost 7 planes. 5 pilots were killed and 2 pilots fall in captivity.
But the mission must be accomplished. You just kept saying that over and over again. The mission of your life, get back in the fighter plane, and the mission of Squadron 115. That's the theme.
Yeah, it's more than that. I wrote it. It says 3 stages process. First, the mission has to be accomplished. That's what I took from my military boarding school. And from the Air Force, I took that not only to be accomplished, but to be perfect, to be elegant, to be beautiful. It's not just to build a table. You have to make a beautiful, perfect table. And from my father, I took that if you have to do anything negative, anything that will put you in awkward position, that you have to do any injustice, no mission justify doing so. So I thought all the time during the war, how can we accomplish the mission? How can we do it as best as we can? And what should we do? What should we do in order not to do injustice or things that are unfair to anyone?
We come back from break. I want to talk about being the commander of that. But Stephen Pressfield, your most famous book, at Gates of Fire, it's about Sparta. Is there any similarity here in this mindset between these Israelis and the Spartans that you wrote about?
Yeah, there's a tremendous similarity in that, I mean, both of them are warrior cultures and have become warrior cultures of necessity. I mean, the one thing that struck me, among many things that struck me when I was over there interviewing people for Lionsgate and when I met Kiora, was here you would meet, hear the music. You would meet people who have never served the last two generations in the United States. We haven't had a draft. You meet anybody in Europe, man or woman, and not only have they served, but they're serving at the current time. And people have fought in five wars. Their sons have fought, their grandsons, their granddaughters.
Different cultures entirely. I'll be right back, America. Solitary is linked at HughHewitt.com. 21 minutes after the hour, Americans, Hugh Hewitt having a fascinating day today. Keeping our eye on the headlines, the president is in Los Angeles screwing up traffic. Turkey is not sending the troops where they need to Kobani. There could be a massacre there by tomorrow morning of untold proportion. Ebola, no new developments of any significance. In studio with me, Joseph Timothy Cook, my retired law partner, who was an A-4 pilot in Vietnam, flying off the carrier. Stephen Pressfield, who wrote the wonderful, amazing book, Gates of Fire, as well as maybe my favorite, Killing Rommel, as well as the books about Alexander that really taught me about Afghanistan. And I wasn't going to read them until I met Stephen. And then finally, most recently, the Lionsgate nonfiction, well, narrative fiction about the Six-Day War. And Stephen has brought along with him to my studio Major General Giora Rom, retired from the Israeli Air Forces, their first ace. His book, Solitary, is now available in English in America. I've linked it at HughHewitt.com. And we're in the third hour, and we're talking about the third phase, when he's brought himself back physically, mentally, and emotionally to the command of a fighter squadron in the Yom Kippur War. And there's a moving couple of pages, which I referred to earlier, where you leave the base. It's about midway through the conflict, and you're going to fly 700 sorties, and you go to your parents' house, and the first person who comes to the door is your two-and-a-half-year-old daughter, Netta. You grab her and you take her out on the lawn, and you realize that she's the only one in the house who won't remember you if you die in this war. It's just beautifully written. Now, I've seen pilots say goodbye to their little children, and you know, you don't really get it unless you've had to do that. But I wonder if other pilots have remarked upon that to you, that scene.
you don't believe how many people refer to that scene specifically.
Touching you in your...
We had a very famous pilot, Avi Lanier, who was who parachuted in Syria, and he was caught alive, but he came back dead. And when my book was published, everybody was speaking about my book. They didn't want to read any book about captivity. And then they were told that I'm mentioning Avi Lanier's name twice in the book, and then decided that Nurit, his little daughter, she was not little at that time, she will read the book and she will tell her mother and her brother if they should read it. So she asked her husband and children to leave the house, and she stayed by herself Friday and Saturday. And then I didn't know that until she called, she gave me a telephone call. And I picked the phone and said, Giora, this is Nurit Lanier. You remember me when I was in kindergarten in the base. I said, I remember you. She said, look, I read all your book, and it's a fascinating book. But then I came to the meeting with Netta. Netta was with Nurit at the same kindergarten.
Oh.
And I broke in crying. I was crying for an hour about the meeting between you and Netta. Now, this is an extreme case because Nurit lost her father. But many people were very touched by that very candid description of the meeting between me and my 2.5 years daughter, which was a very unmilitarily part of the book. But just what you go through, and in the crazy case of Israel, unlike America, too, so to speak, that in the middle of the war, you can find yourself...
That's what's wild.
That you find yourself, go and meet your family, and then... And in fact, you live in two parallel universes. You have your own universe, and your family back in Tel Aviv has their own universe, and there are two parallel universes. And all of a sudden, you go out of your universe... penetrate their universe, which is okay, but then you leave their universe and you go back to your universe. And they know that that might be the last time they saw you. Yeah. And what I wrote, as you mentioned, is that I knew that everybody would have remember me, but Netta, my daughter, she was 2.5 years. And if I am going to be killed tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, next week, she will not be able to remember my image.
And I'm surprised that you're the squadron commander, that they let you do this. I'm surprised that you can. I mean, it's self-discipline to be able to leave Universe One, where you've flown combat sorties, and go to Universe Two, not only to meet your family, but the family of people who are missing, Menachem's parents, yeah. and have that scene. And then immediately go back, grab 4 hours of sleep, I believe it was, yes. and then lead a combat sortie.
That's right. Well, the war, we didn't know how long the war lasted, and we started to let pilots to go home for a couple of hours to meet their families, because the pressure of the families was very heavy. Yom Kippur, it was clear to the whole nation that there was a huge number of casualties. And they were climbing on the walls, you know, the parents, the brothers, the wife, the children. And we decided to let every time a couple of pilots go home at night and come back. And I, at the beginning, I didn't leave my squadron. And then one night, I decided I should go and visit, especially the family of Menachem, who was my good friend and was missing. And so I couldn't help but going through my parents' house where my wife and my daughter stayed during the war. And that's the description of
that. I've got a friend near Nitzim who took me around Israel when I was there. And during the most recent conflict, he sent me a note. He drove to see his son's battalion. He just drove up and brought him stuff and wandered in because that was, you just do it. And that's in your book, too, in 67 in the Lionsgate. The people just show up and they sign up for their battalions.
Right. Retired guys come back, you know, and friends come in civilian clothes and get fitted in, you know, wherever there's a slot.
Well, you can't really do that with a fighter pilot squadron, though, can you? No. And there's another touching detail before we get to break. When you lose someone, you take their car and you park it at the end of the lot.
Yeah. we lost five pilots. It was seven. Five were killed and two were missing. And you go, you know, where the flying gear is there. So I ask one of the secretaries that we had to go to pack their stuff in parcels, in boxes, and to put it aside. And I ask someone else to take their cars and to park them at the end of the parking lot. That's the way. I mean, it's a war. People are being killed. Others are continuing to fly like 2 or 3 times a day, and you have to take all kinds of steps, I mean, to put everything in order.
Tim tells me in the aircraft carrier business that when you'd lose a pilot, you'd have a toast, then you'd fly the next sortie.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah.
You can expand on that if you'd
like. Well, first of all, I'm looking over my shoulder to see if the captain of the carrier is there because we're not allowed to have alcohol on the ship. So we didn't really, but we did. And you know, you lose somebody. Where are they? Are they recoverable? Are they alive? Are they dead? You go through that drill first. But once all that dust settles, you know, you gather up in their stateroom or in your state, wherever and break out a bottle and have a toast. And the next morning, your first brief is at whatever time the schedule says, and off you go.
It is relentless. The pace of the Yom Kippur War is relentless. We come back from break, we're going to talk about that. Is it 13 days total?
No, it's like 21 or 22.
22. Okay, it's even longer than I thought. It's just an amazing, relentless number of combat missions. And we'll talk about how he got control of a squadron with one day's notice before the war begins. Gior Rome is my guest, Stephen Pressfield and Joseph Timothy Cook along with him. Solitary is linked at HughHewitt.com. If you like military history, if you like inspirational literature, if you like Shackleton's endurance, go read this. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. 34 minutes after the hour, America, no news from Kobani. We have a shooting in St. Louis. Sadly, another black teenager shot and killed by an off-duty policeman. There are different competing accounts. I'll update you as that happens. But nothing breaking that I haven't told you about. In studio with me is Major General Gior Rome. He is the first ace in the Israeli Air Force. His brand new book, Solitary, The Crash, Recovery, and Resurrection of an Ace Fighter Pilot, is an amazing book and so timely because we've got men and women who are flying combat missions over ISIS right now. Whenever I hear people say no boots on the ground, I think these guys are in combat, and I can't believe people make light of that. Stephen Pressfield brought him down here, the author of Gates of Fire, most recently Lionsgate. You had a question, Stephen?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you this question. I've been wanting to ask you this for quite a while. It's a writer's question. And, you know, so many people come back from war and they want to write memoirs, right? And the usual war memoir starts, I was born, I went to high school, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But, Giora, you sort of naturally cracked the code here. I mean, the way to write a war memoir is to pick a theme and boil everything down to one, you know, totally focused thing. And you did that. And it's like the thing, it's like an awareness that only a professional writer with years and years of failure behind him does. And so I wanted to ask you, how did you know to do that? Was it just instinct?
I know to recognize a low quality product when I touch it. And all those books, I was born, I was raised, I went to elementary school, I drank my first glass of milk, my parents got married. I know what I didn't want to write. And I was asking myself, how can I be different, which is what I've asked myself all my life. How I can be not one of the crowd. I want to be somebody who is specific, singular. So when I sat down to write, I said I should write it in a different way, in a different time scale, in a different approach that will not be as if I fill a form to get a job in some governmental office. And so I started. And when you start, as you know, once you start and you feel that you let it go, and you can do it only if you're full of experience and emotions that you have accumulated throughout your life, and you let it go, it goes. It just goes by itself. That's the beauty of it.
Did you end up angrier or less angry with your Egyptian captors having written it? Did your emotions change vis-a-vis your Egyptian captors having written the book?
I never hated the Egyptians. During my captivity, there were days or hours or weeks when I was starving that I could kill them and I had an M16 or whatever. But going back, I'm a very rational man, and we have two countries, Egypt and Israel. We were at war. I have seen many good people in Egypt during my captivity. It was not that they were the bad guys and I was the good guy. It's too simplistic. And I never hated the Egyptians, even when I fought against them in the Yom Kippur War. Well, that was the story. We had a war. It was never based on hatred, and I wish I could meet the people I met during my captivity. If you remember the last page or two pages of my book, I think about them.
Yep.
And I don't think about any of them in hatred or in anger or in any grudge.
Has Saeed tried to find you?
They didn't try to find me. I don't think that they ever tried to find me. And if anyone was supposed to look for someone, it was me to try to look for them. Well, I tried a couple of times, even when I was a high-ranking officer. Every time there was a problem and I couldn't do it.
You know, my guess is, and we're going to go to break, is that Aziz, your interrogator, and maybe Saeed, they screwed up. You know, so they get back to base and they find out they let Israel's ace get out. And they never, I mean, their failure is epic. They had you for hundreds of hours of interrogation and they never knew that they had Israel's only ace. That's a major failure. I'm not sure how that well that went down in the Egyptian military. So who knows where the, what happened to those. It's not going to enhance your career to have the boss call you in and say, we had Giora Rome, their number one pilot, and you never figured that out in 3.5 months and 500 hours of interrogation. How do you get control of a combat squadron when you have one day's warning? We'll find out. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. 44 minutes after the hour, America. It's Hugh Hewitt in studio with me, Joseph Timothy Cook and Stephen Pressfield. Cook, my former partner and A4 pilot. Stephen Pressfield, of course, the author most recently of The Lionsgate, which is linked at HughHewitt.com. And Stephen brought Giora Rome, I keep mispronouncing it. Major General Rome was the first Israeli ace. His book, Solitary, is linked at HughHewitt.com. It's in bookstores everywhere. It's at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's an incredible read. You have to take over a squadron on one day's notice in 1970, the day before the war breaks out. The first credit, I think, goes to Iftok Spector, who is the guy who lets you fly with him as his wingman in combat, right? He's the first guy that lets you come back at the when you're not training. You go operational with him when you come back from your injury.
Well, no, that was when I still flew Mirage in a completely different squadron.
But wasn't that your first mission? Not in the war, but your first time you took the pilot?
Yeah, that was the first time I took what we call readiness. You know,
yeah.
So I didn't fly because there was no scramble, and I went down to some an Air Force base in the middle of Sinai for about 48 hours, and nothing happened. Short of the fact that I couldn't sleep for a single moment because it was so close to the Suez Canal, and I knew that in any given moment I can be scrambled to fly to the Suez Canal. And that was the first time I touched the complexity and the difficulty of becoming operational pilot again. But later on, I flew a lot of operational missions, and it takes a lot, and it goes very slow to recover from that captivity.
But no one ever said to you, no one ever said, I don't want to fly with Giora because he damaged goods?
No.
See, that's amazing.
No, I'll tell you why. No one had even the slightest understanding what does it take to fly again after captivity. They related to it as if it is some kind of technicality, as if you broke your leg and they fix your leg, and now you can run again. No one. Only after I published my Hebrew book, dozens of people came to me and said, Giora, we didn't have a clue what you went through. Among other reasons, because we didn't talk about that in the 70s. You had your mission, you had your position, and we were not into the culture of crying one on the shoulders of the others and to speak about personal stuff that much.
When you take over the squadron and Ron is your pal and he calls you up, he's running the base, he says, you get squadron 115. Any hesitation from the young pilots that you were the old guy who got shot down?
On the contrary, I was still remembered as the ace of the 6-day war. And they were very proud that I was selected to be the squadron leader. And they accepted me with full confidence. And in the book, I describe the first night of the Yom Kippur War when I'm talking with all the pilots. And I'm waiting for someone to raise his finger and to say, Giora, maybe you are in the wrong place in the wrong time.
Because you're not ever flown an A4 before.
Yeah, I never flew an A4. Why won't you go back to your Mirage squadron and we will find somebody else?
Tim, how do you feel about that if your commander of your squadron had never flown your plane?
It's insane. It's just nuts.
It's not okay. So anyway, at the end of it,
on the contrary, they looked at me and say, you are the commander. You never flew A4. This is your problem. You are the commander. Take command and lead us and do it good.
Clearly you did, because at the end, one of your pilots says, Commander, go lie down. I'm going to make you dinner. And he loves food. And
yes,
their way of saying you did a good job at the end of these 3 weeks of incredible engagement. But for anyone listening who's assuming command, how do you get it? I mean, that might pin it on you, but how do you get the squadron to believe in you? What's the most important thing? Obviously, someone else promotes you, but it's the men underneath you who have to respect you.
Only two things. The first one is personal example. You're supposed to do. You're supposed to take yourself the toughest missions every day, and the second one is you want to go for a mission. So it's personal example which makes the whole difference. They do not check your IQ. They do not check if you paint very nice or if you play a violin. It's personal experience, a personal example in wartime, and the fact that you are ready to lead the warriors. And it makes no difference if it's pilots or
tankers or
tankers.
Stephen, is that your experience? You've been writing about war for a long time. Is that your experience?
Well, let me just say this. Just from here talking to Giora, if we're ready to go into combat and he's our leader, are we ready to fly behind him right now?
Well, we'll do what we can. I'm not sure he wants me to fly anything ever. But did you ever have a bad commander in the Israeli Defense Forces?
I think that we have. Normally you have better ones and lesser ones, not all of them are the bright of the brightest, but yes, sometimes you have to.
I heard a speech a week and a half ago in a private seminar by a SEAL who said the reason they are so successful is that they have ruthless selection and a continuous examination of how the mission went, in which even the youngest ranking member of the team is empowered to speak truth to the senior member. So ruthless selection, continual innovation, and constant scrutiny. It sounds a lot like your experience.
It's exactly what we have gone through in the last 50 years. And, Ezra Weitzman, who was the president of Israel and he was the commander of the Air Force during the 60s, I was asked once by a veteran pilot, what was Ezra Weitzman's main contribution to the Air Force? And I told him, look, Ezra was the one that convinced Ben-Gurion to buy the 72 Mirage, which is like buying today 72 space shuttles. And he said, Gira, you are wrong. Ezra Weitzman brought into the Air Force the culture that every lieutenant can stand up and speak his opinion as long as he does it in a polite way. He has to speak his opinion, to voice his opinion, and we have to listen to him. So
that's in your book, Stephen.
Right. Well, I got it from Giora.
I got it from Giora. And I heard it echoed in the SEALs 10 days ago. I'll be right back. One more segment. Solitary is Giora Rome's new book. It is available at HughHewitt.com, at Barnes & Noble, Amazon bookstores everywhere. Go and get it. Whether you're a civilian like me or a career military for a long, long time, you'll profit from Solitary. I'll be right back to conclude the program. Stay 55 minutes after the hour, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Normally, you have to belong to the universe to listen to one of these shows, but I'm going to have Dwayne post the audio. He's not going to transcribe it, but he's going to post the audio so you can go and listen to it if you missed some of Giora Rome's conversation about his new book, Solitary. Stephen Pressfield, thank you for bringing him down here. Tim Cook, thanks for adding a little American piloting perspective. Giora, my last question goes to the audience. A lot of people out there have been in combat, and a lot of people are suffering post-traumatic stress disorder, and a lot of people know people like that. So the audience for what the next 2 minutes are is vast. What's your advice to people who are struggling with the trauma? What one friend of mine says, the normal reaction to abnormal circumstances. What's your best advice to all those soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines?
You come back, what you have is the rest of your life in front of you. And you have to make a decision who is going to control the rest of your life, your experience or what you have gone through in the battlefield or yourself. And you can assume that anyone who took part in a war, in a fight where people were killed, when friends were lost, is going through a very traumatic process. But it is yourself and it's your obligation to your family, to your wife, to your children, to go back to normal life. It's your obligation to yourself to have a job that you can hold, that you can keep on living your life as you planned before. So maybe you can have a lot of help from outside, but you should look for your inner forces.
How about candor with people about the trauma?
Candor in what sense?
In telling people what's happening. You've written a book. You've detailed. Is this good for people to do?
Yeah, I think that instead of keeping your internal devils to yourself, you should find a way how to express them and to share them. It's not a shame to feel very bad after war or to be very terrified or not to sleep at night or to wake up six times at night. Share it with someone. Find the forces, find the way that you can heal yourself and take your life in your own hands.
It's also interesting in the book, you have to read it at length, about fear. Stephen, you've written a lot about fear in your other books, but he does so very, very, it's very hard to capture how people who've been in combat, you do it. I don't know how you do it, but from Sparta to Rommel to the Lion's Gate, it's sort of the constant in all of your books.
Hanging out with people like Giora.
That's a good way to do it. Giora Rom, thank you so much. The book is Solitary, The Crash Recovery and Resurrection of an Ace Fighter Pilot. It's available everywhere right now, and you can go and find it at HughHewitt.com. It's linked. Tomorrow we'll have more details on the shooting in St. Louis. The young man was shot 7 or 8 times. That's just coming across in the lower third as Anderson Cooper opens up that list. I'll bring you all the latest details from Kobani, but in the meantime, do yourself a favor, go and order Solitary right now. It's at HughHewitt.com or go directly. The last name is spelled R-O-M-M. G-I-O-R-A Giora Rome. R-O-M-M. You'll thank me. You'll thank him. You'll thank Stephen Pressfield. Talk to you tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.